Hi, this is Laura Robson, back again with Alfie Hewitt and Jack Draper for the fourth and final episode of our short and sweet podcast leading up to Wimbledon. Time. It's 100 years of centre court this summer. Jack's definitely going to play there again.
I saw it as an opportunity to go out there and compete against probably one of the greatest players of all time.
Alfie hopes to play on it in the future.
It's been proven to be able to happen at the other slams, so my question would be, why not Wimbledon?
As for me, I'll be sticking to the commentary box.
Now I can talk openly about what I went through the last couple of years with my injury and stuff.
And don't forget, you can feel the connection this summer with Vodafone, official partner of Wimbledon.
Memories of centre court Wimbledon.
Good for the podcast.
So here we are together again, Jack and Alfie.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Laura.
Episode is focusing on me, so I've been asking you guys the questions. I'm trying to figure out how this is going
to
work.
Yeah, we're ready to turn the tables on this episode and give you a grilling. Let's see what you're talking about.
Alfie looks ready for an interrogation.
It's like a little study room, but it's so cramped in there.
I've been trying to figure that out.
So, shall I start us off then?
Bring it.
Okay, let's get on with the pod.
This is episode 4, my story.
So Laura, what's your earliest Wimbledon memory?
Well, we touched earlier on a different episode about how my family got drunk on the hill. But I think in terms of actually playing, I have to say juniors 2008 was the first time I actually played on the courts. And it was before some of the courts had been refurbished as well. So I have memories of the old court 19, the old court 2, and of course the final on court 1. And it just sort of threw me in at the deep end. And I was convinced after that week that I was going to get like this honorary membership, and everyone told me that I would, but no, that didn't come until many years later. So yeah, I think it just gave me a taste for what Wimbledon's all about, and I just loved it. And even though juniors, as you know, you're stuck in a rangy, you just sit out on the balcony and try and stalk as many pro players as possible. And I think I shook Federer's hand, and yeah, he was so nice to everyone, but one of the other girls that I was playing juniors with at the time said that she would never wash it again, which is maybe a bit much.
That's unreal. And you made your ITF junior debut in 2007 and then won Wimbledon the next year. How did that happen? Like, how does that even happen?
I don't know. I remember I'd done pretty well in like the grade 2 sort of grade 1 events. And then the week before Wimby, I made final of the Roehampton junior event, which is on the grass as well. And I just kept going through the draw, I guess. And the girl that I played in the second round, who I think was number 1 junior at the time, I lost to the week before. So I sort of knew her game, knew that I could beat her. And then from then on, it was like, yeah, why not win the tournament?
Sounds good.
What exactly changed for you then? Did you get more limelight? Was the publicity a lot bigger? How was it?
It was weird. It was really weird. And my family at the time were living almost at the back of the practice courts, like that road behind Orangi. So I was very close to Wimbledon. And yet as soon as the tournament finished, I sort of left because I was getting strangers turning up at my house and things like that. A bit creepy. So I left. I went to Florida and tried to avoid it as much as possible. And my coach at the time was Dutch. So I'd do my training weeks near his house in Amsterdam and just sort of try and stay away from all the pressure of being in the UK.
That doesn't sound good at all. That sounds quite intimidating. I wouldn't want to win Wimbledon if I knew people coming up to my front door.
Yeah, it's just sort of something that you deal with at the time, isn't it? And I always remember it in a positive way. I don't think about all the negative stuff that I'm sure was going on as well. But for me, it was just such a great experience and really gave me an idea of what could be and made me realise how much harder I needed to work to be able to transition to the pros. So in my mind, it was sort of the best thing ever.
I think everyone's different, you know, 14, 15, 16, in terms of their training, you know, how intense they go early on. With hindsight, what would you have done differently, if anything?
I don't know if I would have done anything differently. I think training schedules have changed a lot since I was 14 and 15 anyway. You know, the science is so much more specific now, and there's so many more people involved in creating programs and physio work and things like that. So I think it's not something that we really had at the time in abundance. What I was given was what I did. And I think if anything, I would probably play more tennis in a way, and you know, get your cardio almost from there, which is not something that was happening at the time. It was like very big into the gym, into the track stuff. I think Andy's influence was there as well, because he was doing like massive 800 sessions on the track at the time. So everyone was like, oh, he's doing really well, we better copy him. It was a bit like when Djokovic went gluten-free and then everyone went gluten-free for a year. So you just sort of do what you think is right at the time. But I mean, you guys know as well, you just have to keep adjusting and figure out what works for your body. I mean, you've struggled with a few injuries yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a big thing over training hard, but also being smart with it. You know, I think that's the thing in athletes' heads. They think, oh, like, I have to work really hard to be good, which you do, but you also need to be smart with your training and look after your recovery and make sure that you're giving yourself the best chance to compete at a high level and not be injured the whole time. And I think getting that right at a younger age is obviously very important.
What lessons do you think you learned then from, you know, being 14, 15, 16, coming through the ranks and being in the spotlight?
That it's not easy, that there's so many things that you have to go through to even make it from juniors to seniors. It's not as straightforward as people may think it is. I mean, it is for some players for sure, but not for me. And it was something that I think I played my first pro event in Luxembourg at the WTA when I was 14, and I got absolutely hammered, and everyone's expectations were that I was going to be amazing. And it just takes time, and you have to learn how to win, and it's not straightforward in that you have to learn how to win at challenges, then qualies, then main draw, and eventually maybe you'll get a good result at a slam. But it's a very slow process for most people, where I think, you know, the expectation when you're number one junior in the world is that you're just going to fly through.
Obviously in 2012 it was the London Olympics. How much was that on your radar, and how much were you looking forward to that?
It was definitely on my radar. My family's big Olympics family. It was something that we always watched together. We always got involved. And then I thought there was a chance that I was going to qualify in singles, and I believe an on-site alternate for the singles, but I knew that I was going to play doubles with Heather. I knew that I was going to be in the draw somehow. And I was so pumped picking up all my kit. You got like three suitcases worth of stuff. And then the doubles with Andy was a last minute thing when he decided to play once the tournament had already started. So I wasn't really expecting that part of it. But I'm still bitter because I missed the opening ceremony. We weren't allowed to go. And it was something to do with someone was playing on the Saturday and the opening ceremony is late on the Friday night, and everyone was either going together as a team or no one was allowed to go. So then I sat in my kit in my living room watching the ceremony just in a dark place.
I can't believe that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Alfie, I'm still bitter about it, honestly. It was a once in a lifetime thing, and I totally understand that, yes, you might have felt drained physically the next day, but to me that was a no-brainer.
Oh, I can't believe it. I mean, that's an experience that, you know, you could go to 3-4 different Olympics, Paralympics afterwards. That London Games would never have been able to be beaten. And that's something that, speaking to like Gordon and some of the other guys who was in London compared to Rio, because Rio was my first one. And I was like, wow, this is immense. Like, I remember walking out inside the stadium, which had maybe 100,000 international, but mainly Brazilian fans. And it was just the most incredible atmosphere. It felt like a World Cup, you know, it was just insane. And I remember afterwards saying to Gordon, what was that like? And he was like, oh, that was nothing. He's like, you should have gone out and walked out and heard the roar at the London Olympics and Paralympics. It's just not anywhere close.
I'll get over it eventually.
Because you also played Sharapova under the roof in the singles. So, and what was that experience like?
I did. I remember I had a good win in the first round, and being the Olympics, the draw was so tough. I think the cutoff, I think, was maybe 55. So you knew you were going to have a really tough draw either way. And I'd played Sharapova, I think, the year before at Wimbledon on court one. So I knew what I was going to get. But just the fact that it was the Olympics, so it was a different crowd, and it was much noisier because people were rooting for a country rather than a person, which I think made the biggest difference. So you just had so much more energy, not necessarily tennis fans. I feel like they probably didn't know the rules in the same way that the Wimbledon crowd does. But the roof was closed. The energy was crazy. It was probably the noisiest match I've ever been a part of. And it was one of those matches that you just never forget.
And, you know, you obviously mentioned about playing with Andy. How did that obviously come about? And what was it like to play with him?
We had played together before, twice, at Hopman Cup. So twice? Yeah, we'd played together twice. And we'd done pretty well there in the mixed. So I didn't know that he was going to play. And then I got a message from, I think it was Judy, a couple of days into the tournament. And he only decided to play after he'd lost with Jamie in the men's doubles. So just the fact that we'd played together before, I think, was the deciding factor. And I was pumped because I didn't know that I was going to get another chance. I'd already lost in the singles and the ladies' doubles. So yeah, just that you can get back out there in the Olympics was huge.
So you played your doubles match after Andy had won the gold that day. Can you describe what it must have been like out there?
I went out and watched Andy's singles from the box, actually. So I was getting so hyped. I think I was sat behind Judy, and I just remember how sweaty my palms were because it felt like such a big moment in not only British tennis, but just the fact that in the Olympics, you're obviously trying to get the tally up in the medal table as well. So it was just huge for us to get one in the tennis. And the fact that we knew we were going to get at least a silver in the mixed as well was such a big deal. I mean, the atmosphere was nuts. It was so loud. So many people stayed for the mixed. It was pretty much full. And weirdly enough, my mum is very, very superstitious. So she didn't want to watch it from the player box because she gets way too nervous. So she was sort of moving around the stadium little by little. And every now and then I'd just hear her voice, and Andy would hear her voice as well. And he's like, I swear she wasn't sitting there 10 minutes ago. And actually, my brother was one of the ground staff during the tournament. So he was on the court doing the umbrellas and the towels and stuff for the final. And so we've got a really nice picture at home of Andy and I with the whole ground staff team from the Olympics, which, it's a cool moment.
Yeah, I actually remember being there that day. I watched both the matches, to be fair. And the atmosphere, like you said, was crazy.
It's so loud.
Yeah, it was mad. I also think, in terms of Andy's career as well, that was a huge moment, winning that gold. And then obviously watching you guys together in the doubles was pretty special too, and inspiring, obviously, for a younger guy like myself.
I think it was really cool, the fact that I was able to watch Andy's final from the box and experience centre court as a spectator, and then play on it a couple of hours later for the mixed final. And there's just nothing like it. You only get those feelings at Wimbledon on centre court, even though it was a different crowd at the Olympics. And one of the best stages in the world for tennis, if not the best.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably the best court in the world of tennis, in my opinion.
I thought I was going to get gold. I didn't. I got outserved by Max Murney, who is about a foot taller than me. And we won the first set, and then Murney somehow found an extra 2 foot of kick over my right shoulder. And from then on, it was tough.
Yeah.
Match tiebreak as well, which is
tough.
Just a terrible way to lose a gold medal.
Can you describe the moment? What was it like for you standing on that podium receiving your medal?
I actually don't remember it now. It sounds so bad, but I mean, it goes past in a flash, and then you're on to like the media rounds and all of that. So I should have savored it a bit more in the moment. What was hilarious to me though was I was sponsored by Adidas at the time, who were the major sponsors of the Olympics. And so after we won the medal, they were like, oh, we give all of our Adidas medalists a stack of tickets for all the other sports. And so I was going to Cincinnati literally the day after the final, and couldn't go to any of these events. So my dad and my brother took this stack of tickets and ended up watching men's 200 meter final, 100 meter final, the 800 meter final. They went to the final of the basketball. They went to the velodrome. And I just got picture after picture in the family group chat. And I was literally sitting in my hotel in Cincinnati in qualies, just hating life, because I was like, what am I doing here? I could be watching the Spice Girls at the closing ceremony, watching Usain Bolt break the world record. And instead I was sat with Andy and his team, and my mum was with me, and we were all sat in Whole Foods in Cincinnati, just thinking, what are we doing here?
And you say my memory is good. I mean, that's outrageous memory.
Back to the pod in just a minute. First, this is Tim Henman, excited to be teaming up with Vodafone this summer. It's going to be a great Wimbledon, particularly the chance to discover Wimbledon Uncovered in 360 for the first time, powered by Vodafone and available on wimbledon.com. We're also working with the LTA and Wimbledon to support young British tennis talent through Play Your Way to Wimbledon, powered by Vodafone. Perhaps one day you'll make it all the way to centre court. Follow Vodafone's social channels to keep up with the best of the action and look out for special guest appearances. That's it from me. Now back to Laura, Alfie and Jack.
And there's the volley. Great hands at the net. What a point from the teenager, Jack Draper. Brilliant from Hewitt. He generates such speed across the court. If that is the last we see of Laura Robson, we'll remember a game which, on its day, was a match for the best players in the world.
So, Laura, it's 2014. You've reached the last 16 of Wimbledon and the US Open. Was that when the problem started?
Not just then. It was after Aussie Open 2014, I believe, that my wrist started playing up. And I could feel during the tournament, I think I was in the third round of Aussie Open, and something just didn't feel right in my wrist, and I just couldn't get the same rotation on my forehand. And I went to the tournament doctor in Australia already and just had a scan on it and tried to figure out what was going on, but it wasn't actually solved until a couple of months later when I had surgery. The first surgery in Minnesota at the Mayo Clinic. And yeah, I actually got to know my wrist surgeon so well that every time I'd go back, he'd invite me round for dinner at his house, which is not a good sign. But yeah, lovely bloke.
How many surgeries did you actually have?
So I had two wrists, three hip, along with just about every injection and treatment that you could do that was less invasive. And with my wrist especially, because it would get so inflamed and you can only have three cortisone injections in that area per year, I was routinely hitting that. So yeah, not the healthiest body clearly, but still somehow managed to get back on court.
How tough was that? Because you're obviously only 20 at this point. So how was it dealing with these injuries at such a young age?
Yeah, I mean, you both know as well how difficult it is. And it's so tough when it's stop-start. And you, just when you think that you can get back on court and you've done all the work in the gym and with the physios, and that first hit back is just something's not quite right, and you go back to square one, which is what happened to me so many times, not just with my wrist, but with my hip. And you keep working away and you don't necessarily have the results or the relief of actually getting to a tournament. So it was frustrating. I think it built a lot of character for me because I hadn't really gone through any hardships until then. And yeah, it took me a long time to get back onto the court with my wrist, but yeah, got to know the physios very well.
Were you able to keep the belief in your time off court that you were still going to be able to do well and stuff like that?
I did with my wrist. I thought it wasn't going to be as long as it ended up being. So after 6 months, I was thinking, well, planning to go away to this and this tournament. And I was doing a tournament schedule, but then it just kept getting pushed back longer and longer. So by the time I started again, and I was so desperate to play the grass, which was not necessarily the best idea in hindsight, because I went straight into a big tournament when I really could have been playing challenges and 25Ks just to get more of a feel of getting back into it. But instead I was so desperate to play the grass again that I just made it work. But it just meant that I didn't get the match practice that I should have had.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, was there any point you thought that this was sort of the beginning of the end with your tennis career?
Brutal. The beginning of the end. I'd like to think I never thought like that, but I probably did. I mean, it's so tough to stay positive. And I mean, you both know it's brutal when you're doing months and months of rehab and not really seeing any progress. So I think with my wrist, I was always really positive. And I knew that I'd get back on court. I knew that I'd be out there again. But with my hip after the second surgery, they weren't sure that it was going to have the effect that I wanted it to. So it was a sort of a bit more of a negative mindset even going into the operating room. They were sort of like, we'll do our best, but we don't know for sure. And then by the time I had the third one, it was more for sort of quality of life in 10, 20 years. So yeah, by then it was the beginning of the end. And it still took me a long time to be able to say it to myself as well. But yeah, tough.
How many times did you think about actually retiring before you finally did this year in May? Because obviously you haven't played for a while. Well, why now?
I thought about retiring a couple of times, not with my wrist, just with my hip. I wouldn't be able to put an exact date on it, but it definitely went through my mind. Not after the first surgery either. It was just after the second one, where it just wasn't getting any better, and I was really struggling to even walk my dog and to get around without limping. And it was just a really horrible time, not even in the rehab area or with the physio. It was just tough walking around at home. So it was then that I thought something's really not right here, and I got to think long term. And that's what all the doctors were telling me as well. You got to think long term of what you want your life to look like in 10, 15 years. So that was really when it set in. And that was probably, you know, a year ago already. And it took me till May to officially retire, I guess, because it took me that long to get my head around it. And I knew in Australia this year, by the time I went to visit my parents who live in Melbourne in December, we all sort of knew, but it still took me another couple of months to say it to everyone else.
Let's look at something a little bit more positive now. The future.
Yeah, positive.
What does it hold?
Well, a few more podcasts, a lot more commentary. And I can sort of commit to that more full time now that I know that I'm not playing, which is good because it just allows me to create more of a schedule throughout the year and know where I'm going to be. So yeah, you'll see a lot more of me, but just not in tennis gear.
Yeah. How does that, you know, obviously you've decided now, but you know, you must think, wow, like, I've got a completely new chapter ahead. This is exciting. You know, it's weird. I'm even thinking about it now. I'm 20. I'm thinking about retiring. I'm thinking too much hard work to come. But, like, it must be weird in that situation where it's like, wow, I've done something for the whole of the start of my life. And now I'm sort of moving on to a completely new things. What does that feel like?
It's weird. I mean, you can get the retirement thoughts out of your head. Yeah. You're way too young. And if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have never have thought that I would be retired at 28. It's weird to even say out loud. I'm still so young in the grand scheme of things. But it is exciting. And I think the fact that I was able to officially retire a couple of weeks ago and get it out in the open has made the future more exciting as well, because it doesn't feel like so dark anymore. It doesn't feel as negative as it was a couple of months or last year ago. So yeah, it is exciting, and I've got a long life ahead of me. So all good things to come, hopefully. Right, not long till Wimbledon. One of the things I'm most excited about is the chance to watch Wimbledon Uncovered in 360, powered by Vodafone. Watch it on wimbledon.com. So Wimbledon starts in just a few days. What are your thoughts? Do you think Jack's drawing Djokovic again first round?
I hope I get a bit of better draw than that this year, but I'm definitely looking forward to this year's Wimbledon. And hopefully Alfie as well can get himself Grand Slam number 21, which will only be one behind Rafa then.
I hope so. But come on, between us three and all the podcast listeners, Jack, who do you want first round?
Who don't you want?
Who don't I want? I mean, everyone's incredible at a high level. You know, in the slams, everyone's incredible, obviously. But maybe someone who's got less experience of doing well on a grass court, maybe. I'm not sure who exactly that is.
So you'd like to play Liam Brody?
I don't know. we'll see how he does this week.
Name and shame.
I mean, that would definitely be a tough match playing against a Brit at Wimby.
Alfie, do you feel like it's your time to win the singles at Wimbledon?
I've been saying that for the last 5 years. So we'll see. I'm desperate. I'll be happy with a semi-final this year. It's been a while since I've even made that. So we'll take one round at a time. But if I can get myself to the final, I'll be very happy.
This is the year. Thanks, guys, so much. Alfie, it's been a big test, but we got through it. And yeah, just a big thank you to both of you for being part of this.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, guys.
Enjoyed it.
Laura, you're an awesome host. You've got a good future ahead of yourself.
I'll take it.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks for listening to episode 4. The whole series is now available from wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy Wimbledon and feel the connection this summer with Vodafone, official partner of Wimbledon.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah, that was a good fun. All the best next few weeks.
Laura, thank you. I'll see you in the next few weeks. All right. Yeah.